But he repeats it twice in that verse, that the sheaves are there going to be threshed. And so Armageddon then is a heap of sheaves in a valley in which they're going to be threshed, but that threshing is in fact a judgment. And as far as the word Dan or Don is concerned for judgment, if you turn back to the book of Daniel, you can't do any better than go back to the book of Daniel, because Dan Yael means the judgments of Ael, the judgments of God. And here's a book that's all about the judgments of God, and in Daniel chapter 7 in particular, we have this word occurring three times, speaking of this great judgment which is going to be poured out. So in Daniel chapter 7, and verses 10, 22 and 26, a fiery stream issued and came forth from before him, thousand thousands ministered unto him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The judgment was set, and the books were opened. This chapter is a fairly general chapter as far as the judgments are concerned. It's not specifically speaking about the judgments in Jerusalem. I'm only using it to illustrate the word Dan here, used for judgment. But it's part of the overall judgment of the time of the end. In particular, this is the judgment on the fourth beast, which he's going to speak about. But of course, it involves also all of these other nations as well, and these other beasts. Likewise, verses 22 and 26 use the word. The Ancient of Days came, and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High. And verse 26, but the judgment shall sit, and shall take away his dominion to consume, and to destroy it unto the end. And each time that word judgment occurs, it's this word Dan. Or as I say, if you look it up in a concordance, you might find it Don or even Dean. But there again, it's just the slight difference in the vowel. So Arama, Gay, and Don. So we say that although the word itself occurs only once, the ideas contained in it are found frequently in the Old Testament. The locality is described in Joel chapter 3. We've already looked at that passage. Israel's part is described in Micah chapter 4, and we've already looked at that passage. But there are some other events which would take place after this. For example, when the nations have been threshed, what is left is the chaff. And Daniel speaks about this in chapter 2, in that vision which speaks about the crushing of the image seen in the dream by Nebuchadnezzar. And in Daniel chapter 2 and at verse 35, then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver and the gold broken to pieces together and become like the chaff of the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away that no place was found for them, and the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. That also is a symbol of Armageddon. So we've seen it in Micah, we've seen it in Joel, we've seen it in Daniel. We've seen the threshing of the nations, we've seen the treading out of the stubble by Israel, we've seen the blowing away of the chaff. And the stubble that's left is going to be burned up. And Malachi tells us about this in Malachi chapter 4 and verse 1. For behold, the day cometh that shall burn as an oven, and all the proud, yea, and all that do wickedly shall be stubble. And the day that cometh shall burn them up, saith Yahweh of hosts, that it shall leave them neither root nor branch. But unto you that fear my name shall the Sun of Righteousness. Here are the kings out of the sun's rising, arising with healing in his wings, and ye shall go forth and go up as calves of the stall, and ye shall tread down the wicked, for they shall be ashes under the soles of your feet in that day that I shall do this, saith Yahweh of armies. So once again, you've got Revelation 16 coming in here, not only in the sense of the burning of the stubble, but also of the Sun of Righteousness arising. And so you see the evidence, to me at least anyway, is quite overwhelming that Brother Thomas's definition is scripturally very sound indeed. There is but one step left, and this is the blessing which is going to follow the judgment. And the blessing is that which is pronounced in Psalm 72 and at verse 6. So after the nations have been threshed, after the chaff has been blown away, after the stubble has been burned, and of course the good grain has been extracted from all this, being the saints, then Yahweh finds the earth in a sufficiently humbled condition to be able to bless it. And following therefore the symbology, which we've already set forth, he says in Psalm 72 verse 6, that he shall come down like rain upon the mown grass and as showers that water the earth. And so the grass having been mown, or the harvest having been reaped, he is then ready to then pour down the rain, and new growth will come forth, and that will be represent the blessings which are coming upon the earth subsequent to the battle of Armageddon. Our final comment is then that a general description of the events is found in Revelation 14 verses 14 to 16 and Habakkuk chapter 3 and verse 12. And at that point we've reached the halfway mark. We come now to Revelation chapter 16 verse 17. And the seventh angel poured out his vial into the air, and there came a great voice out of the temple of heaven from the throne saying, "It is done." And there were voices and thunders and lightnings, and there was a great earthquake such as was not since men were upon the earth, so mighty an earthquake and so great. Now this seventh vial is the concluding period of the seventh seal and the seventh trumpet. Remember how the seven trumpets were all concealed into the seventh seal, and the seven vials were all concealed into the seventh trumpet. So we can say then that the seventh vial is the conclusion of the seven trumpets and the seven seals. Now this vial will not begin until after the resurrection period, till after the capture of Jerusalem by Gog's forces and its recovery by the Lord Jesus Christ and the saints. The casting out of the enemy from Jerusalem is followed by the establishment of the nave, or the most holy, and David's throne. These are terms which we've come across in the previous chapters. So that this must precede the outpouring of the wrath into the air, because a great voice goes forth from the nave saying, "It is done." So the nave now has in it the throne. I emphasize this point not because of any difficulties which perhaps we have here, but because there are suggestions that the return of Christ takes place under the seventh vial and not under the sixth vial, and there are complex reasons why some people suggest this. But we point out quite clearly here that the casting out of the enemy from Jerusalem is followed by the establishment of the nave, or the most holy, and the throne therein. Now it is from this throne then that the pronouncement of these judgments on Babylon goes forth. In other words, Armageddon has taken place. The land of Israel has been cleansed. The Lord Jesus Christ is now sitting on David's throne, ruling over the kingdom of Judah. Those who have been refined at Armageddon constitute the refined third of Judah. As a result of the work which he has accomplished preparatory to Armageddon and at Armageddon, we can say then that the land promised to Abraham is now being ruled over by Christ. If you can cast your minds back to the studies we did on Revelation 10, and we showed how that the march of the rainbowed angel from Sinai up through the Arab lands and into the land of Israel, and now as a result of Armageddon, that the land which has actually been conquered by Christ and the saints would be that territory promised to Abraham, which goes from the Euphrates across to the Nile. So he's reigning over the kingdom, or the territory which was promised to Abraham. So ruling there upon that throne, it's at this stage that Psalm 2 sees its fulfillment. "I have set my king upon my holy hill of Zion." and he instructs the nations to fear him, to kiss the Son, lest he be angry and ye perish from the way when his wrath is kindled but a little. And so it is then this edict which goes forth that Babylon must now be destroyed. We've looked at this, of course, under other symbols in such passages as Revelation chapter 14, but we would emphasise that the throne is now established and the judgments on Babylon are subsequent to the judgments at Armageddon. One of the interesting features about this particular section is the reference to the earthquake. And the question often comes up as to just how and when Babylon will be destroyed, and is the earthquake which destroys is the earthquake which splits the Mount of Olives the same as the earthquake which here destroys the city of Babylon? Well, I think in order to get our background to this, we should go back for a few minutes and have a look at Zechariah 14, because Zechariah 14 is not an easy chapter, and I think we want to consolidate our thinking on that one before we start to discuss these other matters. In Zechariah chapter 14, this was the chapter that James alluded to when it speaks about the city of Jerusalem being taken. We're told in verse 3 that it is at this time that Yahweh shall go forth and fight against those nations as when he fought in the day of battle. And verse 4 tells us, and his feet shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives, which is before Jerusalem on the east. Let's stop there for a moment. Many people, in their simplicity, and I don't condemn a simple approach to the Bible at all, but sometimes one has to be careful it's not oversimplifying facts, that many people in their simplicity say, well, you've got Acts chapter 1, verses 10 and 11, which says, this same Jesus which is taken up from you into heaven shall so come in like manner as you've seen him go. And those words were spoken on the Mount of Olives. And Zechariah 14, verse 4 says, his feet shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives. Well, putting those two verses together, it obviously tells us that when Jesus Christ returns to the earth, he will come down and land on the Mount of Olives just as he physically went up from the Mount of Olives. Sounds very plausible if you just take those verses in their simplicity. Well, let's examine them a little more closely. Verse 4 of Zechariah 14. And, no problem with that word, his, who's his? Well, they say Jesus. Doesn't say Jesus. Who's the his? Well, his is Yahweh. Ah, all right. You say, what's the difference? It could be Jesus bearing the name of Yahweh. Oh, yes. But it doesn't say that. It says his feet. What are the feet of Yahweh? Well, this is a symbolical chapter. There's a fair bit of symbolical language in here. Whilst it's obviously talking about the city of Jerusalem literally, there's no doubt about that, because it's talking about an invasion of the city and the Mount of Olives, there are certain symbologies associated with this. Because here you've got a mountain splitting in two. And I'm not trying to be facetious when I say this, but if we were to picture the Lord descending from heaven, landing on the Mount of Olives, and as he stands there, the Mount of Olives splits underneath him, with the northern half going 3 miles to the north and the southern one going 33 miles to the south, does he have one foot on the northern part and the other foot on the southern part? I'm not trying to be facetious about this. Because the Mount of Olives splits at the moment, we get this descent of Yahweh's feet upon the Mount of Olives. Well, the feet of Yahweh is obviously a term here which is used in the symbology of both Daniel and Revelation as reminiscent of as representative of the fact that the multitudinous Yahweh, and we know it's the multitudinous Yahweh because verse 9 tells us that Yahweh shall be king over all the earth, in that day there shall be one Yahweh and his name one. So that the Yahweh name will be now manifested in the multitude of saints. The judgments are going to be poured out upon the city of Jerusalem associated with a great earthquake, and that this is going to be under the direction of the feet of Yahweh. For example, to explain this, go back to Daniel chapter 10, so similar to Revelation chapter 1. In Daniel chapter 10, where you've got this vision of the multitudinous Christ described as the man of the one, You have there in verses 5 and 6 the symbolic representations of the characteristics of this man. So verse 5 says, I lifted up mine eyes and looked, and behold, a certain man clothed in linen. How fitting. The first thing he sees is the linen garment. That was what the sixth vial told us the Lord would be looking for. Blessed are those that have got their garments firmly in place. And he's clothed in linen because he's girded with a golden girdle. So there it is. He's the one that the Lord found watching when he came, clothed with a linen garment, girded with a golden girdle. Now the work that this man has to perform is described in these terms. His body was like the beryl, his face as the appearance of lightning, his eyes as lamps of fire, and his arms and his feet like in colour to polished brass, and the voice of his words like the voice of a multitude. I'm not going to spend any time expounding this in detail, but we've got here his face like lightning, that's divine anger. His arms and his feet like to polished brass. Ezekiel and Revelation point out that these feet are burning feet, because these feet are going to tread down the nations. The feet of Yahweh here, or the feet of this man of the one, represent the militant aspect of the work which the saints are to perform. And above all, the voice of his words like the voice of a multitude, taking forward the Aeonian gospel to the world. But the feet of Yahweh are represented as burning, both in Ezekiel and in Daniel and in Revelation. So that the feet of Yahweh represent the militant aspect, and they represent the feet which are going to carry forth the judgments of God. You remember in our special effort this year, we looked at the feet of those that had beautiful feet. The feet of those who at this present stage took forth the gospel to the nation. But those people who today bear beautiful feet are in the kingdom age, or at least at this particular stage of the preparing of the kingdom age, are going to have feet which are burning feet. And they will be the feet of Yahweh which will stand upon the Mount of Olives. And so it's going to be then the saints of God in militant manifestation, represented by the feet of Yahweh, which are going to appear here. And at that same time, there is going to be this earthquake which is going to split the Mount of Olives. So much so that we're told that the Mount of Olives shall cleave in the midst thereof toward the east and toward the west, and there shall be a very great valley, and half of the mountain shall remove toward the north and half of it toward the south. If we come down to verse 10 for a moment, we're told that all the land shall be turned as a plain, or as the Arabah. It's that depression. It shall be turned as a it shall become a depression from Geba, that is Gibeah, 3 miles north of Jerusalem, to Rimmon, 33 miles south of Jerusalem, and it shall be lifted up and inhabited in her place. So as a result of the depression of the land, Jerusalem itself will appear as a mountain which is elevated. Doesn't necessarily mean that Jerusalem's got to go up, because the rest of the land will go down respective to it. And at the present moment, Jerusalem is 2,500 feet above sea level. So if the rest of it is made a plain or a depression, Jerusalem then becomes a great mountain. That's as a result of this earthquake. But going back now to verse 5, ye shall flee to the valley of the mountains, for the valley of the mountains shall reach unto Azal. Yea, ye shall flee like as ye fled from before the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah, and Yahweh my Elohim shall come, and all the saints with thee. The valley of the mountains, which is going to reach unto Azal. There is no known place by the name of Azal. Rotherham, however, translates the word Azal by the meaning of the word, which is very near, or we are told it can also mean the separate place. So it is suggested that this means that this valley, which is created as a result of the Mount of Olives going north and south, you've therefore got an east-west valley. And that east-west valley would come from Jerusalem, from the place which is very near, or the separate place, if you like, and would go down in an easterly direction, well, down to the area of the River Jordan. And so that this valley will achieve two things. It will allow at this stage the Jews to flee from the city of Jerusalem. And we know that many of them will take refuge in the area of Jordan. They will flee, but that same valley will also become the door of hope. When after Jerusalem has been cleansed, the remaining Jewish people throughout the world will come up through this valley, which in times past was the Valley of Achor, And the valley of Achor will now become a door of hope. So then this valley has been created as a result of this earthquake here in Zechariah 14. Now, to point out the fact that this earthquake will take place under the sixth vial and not under the seventh vial, in other words, it is not the earthquake of the seventh vial, but it is an earthquake which would be synchronous with the sixth vial. We have in verses 6 and 7 that it shall come to pass in that day that the light shall not be clear nor dark, but it shall be one day which will be known to Yahweh, not day nor night, but it shall come to pass that at evening time it shall be light. A very difficult translation. One of the very famous commentators of Christendom by the name of Ellicott says that the book of Zechariah is the most difficult book in the Bible. Of that book, chapter 14 is the most difficult chapter, and of that chapter, verses 6 and 7 are the most difficult verses. So according to him, these are the two most difficult verses in the whole of the Bible. Well, they probably would be to him, because he didn't know anything about the truth. Brother Thomas, though, has a translation which is very similar to the Revised Version translation. And putting them together, we have Brother Thomas's translation saying this: "And it shall be in that day, there shall be no brightness, the splendid ones drawing in. And it shall be one day that shall be known to Yahweh, neither day nor night. But it shall be that at the time of evening, there shall be brightness." So that the day of Yahweh, which is referred to here in this chapter, commences in verse 3 as a day of battle, during which time we are told that the splendid ones draw in. Or as the Revised Version says, the bright ones shall contract themselves, so that the saints do not reveal themselves in the brightness and the fullness of their glory, which they will possess during the millennium. But we are told at evening time it shall be light. Now, evening to the Jew is the beginning of the next day. 6 o'clock in the evening is the beginning of the next day. So when it says that evening time there shall be light, it's saying that at the beginning of the day, that is the beginning of the millennial day, when the judgments have been completed, then shall the saints shine forth in the fullness of their glory. And that is referred to in Ezekiel in chapter 43, where in the context of describing the temple which will be built and the return of that glory into the temple, he says in verses 1-4 of Ezekiel 43, that afterward he brought me to the gate, even the gate that looketh toward the east. And behold, the glory of the Elohim of Israel came from the way of the east, the kings out of the sun's rising. And his voice was like a noise of many waters. That's Daniel's man of the one. And the earth shined with his glory. So it's now the evening time, the beginning of the millennial day, the end of that 50-year period of judgment. And it was according to the appearance of the vision which I saw, even according to the vision that I saw when I came to destroy the city. And the visions were like the vision that I saw by the river Kibar, and I fell upon my face. And the glory of Yahweh came into the house by the way of the gate whose prospect is toward the east. Now, we're getting a fair way away from Revelation. Step by step we've got further and further away. Now let's come right back. What we're saying is this: we'll go back the same way we came. Going back then to Zechariah 14, he's telling us that when these judgments are poured out, that the splendid ones or the bright ones will have withdrawn themselves. They will not yet be manifesting themselves in their glory. They will be immortalized. Yes, they will be immortalized, but the judgments which will be getting poured out will not be obviously the result of the work of the saints. That, I think, is what it is telling us. They are the judgments of God. They will be overseen by the saints, but the saints are not manifesting to the world divine glory. Not until that glory comes into the temple. And that won't be, of course, until after that valley becomes not the means of escape for Jews, but the means of bringing them back into the land, when it becomes a door of hope. So at this stage, the splendid ones have withdrawn themselves while this earthquake takes place. Well, when the earthquake has taken place, then, of course, the Lord can become enthroned in Zion. The nave can be opened, and he can issue decrees forth from Jerusalem to the nations to accept his judgment. So going back then to not to accept his judgments, to accept his offer of mercy unto them, and that if they don't accept his offer of mercy, they will have to experience his judgments. So going back to Revelation then, we know from what we've seen in Revelation chapter 14 that this is described as the work of three angels. The angel in mid-heaven, Revelation 14 verses 6 and 7, offering them mercy, and then after that, declaring that Babylon is fallen. Well, that brings us back to Revelation 16, and that's the story which we've got now in the seventh vial, and it's described as an earthquake. So obviously the earthquake which destroys the city of Rome is not the same earthquake that splits the Mount of Olives. Brother Thomas makes the comment that around this time there are many earthquakes that are taking place. You may have read that in that section from Eureka which was set down for the reading for tonight. He points out that this is a period of earthquakes. And so, although we would suggest that the earthquake referred to here in Revelation 16 is essentially a political earthquake, it would appear from the descriptions given in greater detail in chapters 17 and 18 that it could also well be a literal earthquake which destroys the city of Rome. The terms which are used there seem very strongly to suggest the actual destruction of the city itself. And so there were voices and thunders and lightnings and a great earthquake. Well, we've been through these terms before. We went through them in quite a lot of detail when we looked at, I think it was Revelation chapter 10 from memory, where we looked at thunders, that's right, thunders and voices and lightnings. We went through that in quite a bit of detail, so we won't go through these terms again, but they are descriptive in a general sense of God's judgments. And the great city was divided into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell, and great Babylon came in remembrance before God to give unto her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of his wrath. As to the three parts into which the great city Babylon is divided, Brother Thomas makes the statement, we are left without positive information. It is probable, however, that it answers to the sections of verse 13. The dragon, or the Constantinopolitan power dominated by Russia, will be overthrown first, followed by the false prophet, and finally the Catholic powers of Europe. In other words, the dragon, the false prophet, and the beast. And whilst, as Brother Thomas says, we are left without exact description of what these three divisions are, he feels they are answerable to the three frog-like spirits back under the sixth vial, that whilst at Armageddon the dragon power is humbled, it still leaves the false prophet and the beast virtually unscathed. And so the division of the destruction on the whole system of Babylon is in a sense a threefold judgment, and that possibly the three parts here would refer to that. That's Brother Thomas's suggestion. I think it's essentially a good one. I think it probably goes a little bit further than that in general terms, because you remember this threefold division was quite a familiar one in the judgments of Rome in the past. You remember the threefold division of the Roman Empire were terms that we came across, I think it was back in chapter 8 or chapter 9, where you came across the third part. Remember the third part being destroyed, and the third part, another third part suffering this and that. So I think it's a typical judgment down through the ages which Rome has experienced, but as far as its latter day one is concerned, well, it will be poured out in three stages. First the dragon, then the false prophet, and then the beast. And then he goes on to say, and every island fled away, as John goes on to say, and the mountains were not found, and there fell upon men a great hail out of heaven, every stone about the weight of a talent, and men blasphemed God because of the plague of the hail, for the plague thereof was exceeding great. Now, when it talks about islands, a natural island is land entirely surrounded by water. A political island is analogous thereto, as it is a kingdom or state insulated from all other waters or peoples by which it is surrounded. Mountains, on the other hand, refer to political powers, such as the kingdom of Babylon in the past was so described by Jeremiah in chapter 51 verse 25. So this verse indicates to us that all political powers, whether they're great powers or whether they're small powers, whether they're mountains or whether they're islands, will all become subject to this stone kingdom of Judah, which itself will grow and eventually fill the whole earth. The stone kingdom of Judah, you know, that little stone which smote the image on the feet, gradually grew until it became a great mountain, and then ultimately to fill the whole earth. Brother Thomas makes the comment that when a government sends forth its armies to lay waste its adversaries and their countries with fire and sword, its troops are a storm or plague of hail, and each individual trooper is a hailstone of a certain weight. Hence, of course, they are stormtroopers, aren't they? That's what he's saying. Let me read that again. It's a nice bit of reasoning, isn't it? When a government sends forth its armies to lay waste its adversaries and their countries with fire and sword, its troops are a storm or plague of hail, and each individual trooper is a hailstone of a certain weight. Again, the natural elements are used as a symbolic representation here of Yahweh's judgment. After the hail of the talent weight ceases, the wrath of the seventh vial, we're told, burns no more. The beast and the false prophet are destroyed, the dragon is bound and shut down in the abyss, the ten horns are conquered, and nothing remains but the new Jerusalem government ruling in righteousness, a world of regenerated nations blessed in Abraham and his seed for 1,000 years. And so this brings us down then to the end of that 50-year period. The period which started with Armageddon, the 10 years of the resurrection, the judgment, and the battle of Armageddon, followed by the 40 years symbolized by the 1600 furlongs of Revelation chapter 14, bringing us down to the period when Rome has finally been destroyed and when the kingdom is now ready to be commenced and when the glory can enter in. Obviously, though, these final judgments of Rome are to form a very significant part of the visions of the time of the end, because we're going to find, God willing, in subsequent studies that chapter 17, chapter 18, and to some extent chapter 19 as well, deal with this final judgment on Rome. And so we will reserve that until our future studies. As far as we're concerned, in our own physical relationship to these things, we might say, we live at the epoch of the fulfilment of verse 15 of Revelation chapter 16. And so we do trust, brethren and sisters, that we do find the time to study these things, to read the scriptures concerning them, and to certainly read books like Eureka, that the Lord, when he comes, will find us watching, because our minds will have been reinforced with that oil of the word and with the power of the writings of our pioneers, that golden girdle will be found about us, holding that garment tightly in place. Blessed therefore is he that watcheth and keepeth his garments.
We'll bring our present meeting to a close, brethren and sisters, through prayer, after we've sung together hymn number 143. Hymn 143.